It is like the old game of Nuts and May, in which the one who is sent to fetch her away is gripped round the waist by the leader of a chain of supporters. The real pressure comes on his own abdominal muscles, as anyone who has played the game will remember. And when the magical operation is over, what then? Will the operator be left to enjoy his victim in peace? Is it likely? This is the mystical basis of the story of Faust. The devil might be not only willing but anxious to enable Dr. Faustus to win Margarita, but he came for his soul at the appointed time. We may also remember that if Margarita had not responded to the lure of the jewel song, she would not have fallen a victim. The weak spot in the defense was after all in her own nature. We have considered the modus operandi of telepathic suggestion in detail because it forms the real basis of every kind of occult attack. Whether it be a discarnate entity, a being of another order of evolution, a demon from the pit, or merely the panic, stricken soul of a selfish friend, clinging to the life of form regardless of consequences, in all cases the opening gambit is the same. Until the aura is pierced, there can be no entrance to the soul. And the aura is always pierced from within by the response of fear or desire going out towards the attacking entity. If we can inhibit that instinctive emotional reaction, the edge of the aura will remain impenetrable, and will be as sure a defense against psychic invasion as the healthy and unbroken skin is a defense against bacterial infection. It happens sometimes, however, that a rapport has been formed with the attacking entity in a previous incarnation. And therefore it holds, as it were, the key to the postern. Such a problem is a very difficult one, and external assistance is needed for its solution. The difficulty is increased by the fact that the victim is often disinclined to allow the break to be made, being bound to the attacking entity, whether discarnate or incarnate, by bonds of fascination, or even genuine affection. A case with which I was acquainted throws so much light on various aspects of psychic interference by incarnate souls operating out of their bodies that it is of value to quote it at length. In the summer of 1926, I saw in the papers a short paragraph describing the death of a certain man and his wife, which took place within a few hours of each other. A couple of years previously, I had been consulted by a friend of the wife, who was deeply perturbed about the state of affairs, and suspected psychic interference. The wife, Mrs. C., we will call her, had begun to be troubled by nightmares, waking up in a state of intense fear, hearing the echoes of menacing words ringing in her ears. At about the same time, the husband, Mr. C., developed what at first sight looked like epileptic fits. A careful diagnosis by specialists, however, determined that although epileptiform, they were not true epilepsy. Epilepsy is due either to a congenital tendency, whose nature is not fully understood by medical science, or to some injury or disease of the brain. In congenital epilepsy, the disease shows itself early in life. In fits due to disease, other symptoms are present which can be detected by a physical examination, such as changes in the eye that are revealed by the ophthalmoscope. The diagnosis can therefore be definitely established. Moreover, there is one sure sign by means of which an epileptic fit can be distinguished with certainty from a hysterical or psychic seizure. In true epilepsy, the urine is involuntarily voided in the course of the fit. This is a sure sign, and when it is absent, we are safe in saying that the fit is not epileptic, whatever else it may be. This is a useful point for those who have to deal with the pathologies that afflict the psychic temperament, for they will see plenty of seizures, and a sure method of distinguishing those that are of organic origin is very useful. We must not, however, conclude that all cases of such incontinence are epileptics, for there are many other causes, both organic and functional. In the case of Mr. C., this cardinal symptom was lacking. The attacks, moreover, always took place in sleep, and it seemed as if they were more of the form of severe nightmare, verging on somnambulism. It was a curious factor in the case that Mrs. C.'s nightmares usually heralded Mr. C.'s attacks. These occurrences showed a certain cyclic regularity, occurring about once a month. In the case of a woman, this would naturally be referred to the 28-day cycle of her nature, but in the case of a man, no such explanation was forthcoming, and we therefore had to look for another 28-day cycle to explain his periodicity. The only other cycle of this period is that of the phases of the moon. We were then confronted by a correlation of epileptiform attacks, which had no organic basis, the nightmares of a second person, and the phases of the moon. Some theory had to be found which would resume these three and explain their interrelationship. A dream is commonly the first way in which psychic manifestations make themselves known, the subconscious perceptions being reflected into consciousness in this form. It is held by many occultists that congenital epilepsy, as distinguished from that due to tumors of the brain, has its roots in the operations of black magic or witchcraft in which the sufferer participated in a past life, whether as practitioner or victim, the fifth being an astral struggle with a discarnate entity, reflected on the physical body by means of the well-known phenomenon of repercussion. The moon plays a very important part in all occult operations, different tides being available at different phases of her cycle. Persephone, Diana and Hecate, all aspects of Luna, are three very different persons. It therefore appeared probable that as the physical investigation had drawn blank, a psychic investigation might yield fruits. One was performed, and with the following results. Nothing at all was discerned with regard to Mrs. C. She was merely what lawyers call an accessory after the fact. But the psychic trail of Mr. C. was soon picked up and followed, and it appeared that in his last incarnation he had been associated with two women, mother and daughter, who had practiced witchcraft for his benefit. The younger of the two women had been for a short time his mistress. Mother and daughter had paid the penalty for their crimes, but their male partner had escaped. The diagnosis was as follows. It is the younger witch that is at the bottom of the trouble. It is her astral visits which cause the seizures of Mr. C, and the nightmares of Mrs. C, and they correlate with the phases of the moon because certain phases are favorable for the operation she performs and she therefore takes advantage of them. The question now remains, is this woman in incarnation or not? That is to say, is the midnight visit paid in an astral body projected from a living human being, or by an earth-bound spirit which has succeeded in evading the second death? Mrs. C. had by now been taken into the confidence of the mutual friend who was concerned for her welfare, and lent a ready ear to the suggestion that some psychic influence might be at the bottom of the trouble, for this explanation coincided with her own intuitions in the matter, intuitions she had not dared to divulge for fear of ridicule. When asked if she could identify anyone in the circle of her husband's acquaintances who might prove to be the younger witch, she replied immediately that she could without any difficulty identify both the women, and told the following curious story. The older witch she identified as her husband's mother, an aged lady who occupied a suite of rooms in their house. For this inoffensive old creature Mrs. C. had always had a peculiar horror and repulsion, although admitting there were no rational grounds for it, and honestly endeavoring to do her duty by her. So great was her horror of the old lady that she would never remain in the house after her husband had left for his office in the morning, but went out herself to her club if she had no other engagement. Among the frequenters of the house was an intimate friend of the elder Mrs. C., a woman of peculiar psychic temperament, who always called the old lady mother and was singularly attached to her. She was also very attached to Mr. C., but her feelings never exceeded, outwardly at any rate, the bounds of propriety, and Mr. C., who was sincerely attached to his own wife, never paid the slightest attention to her, looking upon her as his mother's friend, and as such to be tolerated. Mrs. C. unhesitatingly identified Miss X, as we will call her, as the younger witch. Inquiries were then made regarding her history, and a very curious story unfolded. As a young girl, she had become engaged to a man who, soon after the engagement was announced, had developed galloping consumption and died after a short illness with a violent hemorrhage. Soon after this, Miss X's sister also became engaged, and by a strange fatality her lover shared the same fate, dying as died the other man, in a flood of his own blood. Years went by, and Miss X became engaged again. Soon the second lover fell ill, not, this time, with galloping consumption, but with a more lingering form of the complaint, in which hemorrhage was the principal symptom. He seemed to linger on from hemorrhage to hemorrhage, and this went on for years. Miss X, a woman of considerable private means, took a house, installed Nant as a chaperone, and took her fiancé to live there and be nursed by her. Soon the aunt developed symptoms of illness. She appeared to be drained of all vitality and for days at a time would lie unconscious, but no specific cause was ever discovered for her illness. This peculiar ménage continued for years. Miss X, living in her big house with these two moribund creatures lingering on from attack to attack. She was a constant visitor at the home of the C.S., both during the lifetime of Mr. C.S.'s first wife and that of his second, the friend of my friend. On the death of Mr. C.S.'s first wife she had great hopes, it was observed, that his attentions would turn towards herself, but they did not. Nevertheless she swallowed her chagrin, and succeeded in maintaining her foothold as an intimate friend of the family when the new Mrs. C. came to preside over the household. Certain methods of protection were suggested to Mrs. C., which helped her considerably, but it was not possible to exclude Miss X. from the house owing to her intimacy with the old lady. In due course, however, old Mrs. C. was gathered to her father's, and then young Mrs. C. put her foot down and said she would have no more to do with Miss X. Mr. C. concurred in this, as he had always had a repulsion for Miss X, and had only tolerated her for his mother's sake. Soon after this Mrs. C. began to feel unwell, the indisposition slowly progressed, until finally, although she had no definite symptoms, she was obliged to consult a doctor on account of her steadily increasing weakness and sense of malaise. A diagnosis of rapidly growing cancer of the womb was made. An operation was performed, which gave temporary relief. It was not expected to do any more, and she went downhill steadily. Towards the end she lapsed into unconsciousness, and at the same time, Mr. C. also became unconscious, apparently having one of his seizures in sleep, from which he never awakened. They died within a few hours of each other. Mr. C.'s first wife had also died of cancer of the womb. About this time Miss X.'s aunt and fiancé died within a short time of each other, and the last that was heard of Miss X was that she had been removed to a nursing home in the country with a severe mental breakdown. Taken separately, any of the incidents in this strange eventful history can be explained away, but taken together they make a curious story, especially when it is remembered that without any previous information a psychic investigation had spotted the existence of a person with abnormal faculties who was interested in Mr. C. Cancer is a disease upon which certain occult hypotheses throw a good deal of light. It is believed to be a disease of the etheric double, not of the physical body, and that a cancer elemental is the infective factor. To prove or disprove anything concerning the foregoing story is impossible, but the following occult hypothesis may explain much. If this hypothesis be not accepted, readers may find an interesting exercise for their ingenuity in constructing another that shall explain more satisfactorily the circumstances of the case. Miss X retained subconsciously the knowledge and powers that had been hers during the previous life when she was implicated in the witch cult. She also retained her passion for Mr. C., a passion which was obviously unrequited. She employed her power of projection of the astral body to visit Mr. C. at night, during sleep. In the absence of details it is impossible to decide definitely whether the fit of Mr. C. was a struggle or an embrace. It might be either, or it might be both, an initial struggle ending in an embrace. The dreams of Mrs. C. obviously related to the same astral visitant who caused the seizures of Mr. C. There is, unfortunately, no record to show at what phase of the moon these attacks took place, but presumably at the Hecate phase, which is the period of evil witchcraft. The condition of Miss X's fiancé and aunt and the death of her first love point markedly towards vampirism. It is difficult to believe that a consumptive would continue for so many years without his disease either being checked or making definite progress. It is difficult to say what the connection, if any, might be between Miss X and the death of her sister's lover, but it is a curious thing that three men, associated with this ill-omened household as prospective husbands, should lose their lives in the same way. This, together with the mysterious illness of the aunt, are very suspicious. As noted before, any one of these incidents could be explained away, but taken together they call for thought. It is also curious that Miss X should keep her fiancé in her house and yet not marry him. From every normal point of view, an arrangement with many drawbacks and no advantages. On the other hand, if her feelings were fixed upon Mr. C, and were obtaining satisfaction by astral visits, she would naturally not want to break her rapport with the man she loved by giving herself to the man she did not love. If she were a vampire, her motive for keeping the aunt and lover in her house, and their condition, would be readily explained. Also her breakdown, which followed immediately upon their deaths. The fact that Mr. C's first wife died of cancer of the womb does not in itself call for remark, but it is a curious thing that he should lose his second wife from the same disease. Cancer is not as common as all that, and in any case, there are many available sites beside the womb. On the other hand, Diana, one of the aspects of Luna, of whom Hecate, the goddess of witches, was another, presides over the female reproductive organs. The illness of Mrs. C began to show itself soon after Miss X was excluded from the house. Finally, what shall we say concerning the deaths of the three people most intimately associated with Miss X? Within a short time of each other, and her immediate breakdown, in the absence of details any conclusion must be guesswork, but we have good grounds for supposing that Miss X's magical operations were attended by some mishap. It may be said that such a theory is the wildest improbability and does violence to all the laws of evidence. Let it, however, be borne in mind that 2 years before these matters eventuated, the work of a witch in connection with Mr. C's epileptiform attacks was suspected and the nature of her relationship to him was indicated, and subsequent inquiries revealed the curious facts in connection with Miss X's history and ménage. Let it also be noted that the happenings which subsequently occurred are such as have been recorded in many accounts of witch trials. It is a scientific maxim that the power to foretell the course of phenomena is a good indication of the truth of a theory. Chapter 3: A Case of Modern Witchcraft. The part played by the ex-witch in a cult attack is very marked. Again and again do the investigations of independent psychics point to witchcraft in a previous incarnation when trouble of this sort is afoot. The motive is nearly always vengeance. But there is also good reason to believe that the projection of the astral body takes place involuntarily during sleep, and is not deliberately willed by the offender. Very many people who are at present psychics and sensitives got their training in the covens of medieval witchcraft, and for this reason experienced occultists are very wary of the natural psychic, as distinguished from the initiate with his technique of psychism. Where psychism and mental unbalance are found conjoined with a malevolent disposition, there is strong presumption that the cult of Diabolus is not far to seek. A curious set of happenings, in which I myself was one of the actors, throws a good deal of light on this by no means uncommon occurrence. It was in the early days of my interest in occultism, when I was still buying nay experience by the expensive but effectual method of running my head into obstacles, I made the acquaintance of a woman who was interested in psychic matters. She was a person of the most extreme sensitiveness to anything unclean or ugly, fastidious to a degree in her personal habits, living almost exclusively on uncooked vegetarian foods, even refusing eggs as too stimulating. Although not an animal lover, she was morbidly humanitarian, reading with gusto those papers which give lurid and detailed descriptions of vivisection experiments. Had I been older and wiser, I should have recognized the significance of her ultra-cleanliness and ultra-sensitiveness as marking the ab-reaction of a sadistic temperament, sadism being a pathology of the emotional nature in which the sex instinct takes the form of an impulse to inflict pain. Not having learned then many things which I now know, I looked upon her characteristics as indicative of an exalted spirituality. At the time I knew her, she was verging on a breakdown, which was alleged to be due to overwork, and she was very anxious to get away from cities and back to nature. I was just leaving London to take up my residence at an occult college which was hidden away in the sandy fastnesses of the Hampshire Barrens. In the innocence of my heart, I suggested that she might come down there and help with the domestic duties. The suggestion was acted upon, and a few days after my own arrival, Miss L. joined us. She seemed quite normal, made herself agreeable, and was well liked. One incident, however, in the light of subsequent events, was significant. On getting out of the ancient fly in which she had driven from the station, she immediately went and patted the still more ancient horse that drew it. That beast, usually sunk in an apathy from which he was with difficulty roused when action was required of him, galvanized into life at her touch as if she had stung him. He threw up his head, backed, snorted, and nearly turned the equipage over in the ditch, to the amazement of his jinn, who declared he had never been known to do such a thing before, and viewed our visitor with disfavor. Miss L., however, appeared quite normal, made herself agreeable, and was given a friendly reception by the humans at any rate. That night I was awakened by nightmare, a thing to which I am not usually subject. I struggled with a weight on my chest, and even after consciousness had fully returned, the room seemed full of evil. I performed such simple banishing formula as I knew, and peace was restored. At breakfast next morning, an assembly of blear-eyed people met together, complaining of having passed disturbed nights. We compared notes, and found we had all, some six or seven of us, had similar nightmares, and proceeded to exchange experiences. The effect of this upon Miss L. was curious. She squirmed upon her chair as if it had suddenly become red, hot, and said with much emphasis, "These things should not be discussed. It is most unwholesome." Out of deference to her feelings we desisted. But presently up to the open window came another member of our community, a woman who slept in an open air shelter at some little distance from the house. We inquired after her health, as usual, and she replied that she was not feeling very well, as she had slept badly, and proceeded to recount the same nightmare as the rest of us. Later on in the morning, another lady, who had a house a little way down the road, arrived, and she in her turn told of a similar nightmare. These nightmares continued, on and off for the next few days, to afflict different members of the community. They were vague and nebulous, and there was nothing we could pitch upon for diagnostic purposes, and we put it down to indigestion caused by the village baker's version of war bread. Then one day I had a quarrel with Miss L. She had conceived a crush for me. I have a constitutional repulsion for crushes and give them scant politeness, and she complained bitterly of my lack of responsiveness. Whatever may be the rights and wrongs of the case, I had roused her resentment in good earnest. That night I was afflicted with the most violent nightmare I have ever had in my life, waking from sleep with the terrible sense of oppression on my chest, as if someone were holding me down, or lying upon me. I saw distinctly the head of Miss L., reduced to the size of an orange, floating in the air at the foot of my bed, and snapping its teeth at me. It was the most malignant thing I have ever seen. Still not attaching any psychic significance to my experiences, and being firmly convinced that the local baker was responsible, I told no one of my dream, thinking it one of those things that are better kept to oneself. But when the members of the community came to talk matters over in the light of subsequent events, we found that two other people had similar experiences. A night or two later, however, as it came to bed time, I was overcome with a sense of impending evil, as if something dangerous were lurking in the bushes around the house threatening attack. So strong was this sensation that I came down from my room and went all round the house, testing the catches of the windows to make sure that all was secure. Miss L. heard me, and called out to know what I was doing. I told her of my feelings. "You silly child," she said, "it is no use latching the windows. The danger is not outside the house but in it. Go to bed, and be sure and lock your door. She would give no answer to my questions except to reiterate that I should lock my door. This was the first night I had slept in that house, previously having been in a cottage on the opposite side of the road. I did not lock my door because the night was intolerably hot in the room and the window small. I compromised, however, by putting an enamel slop pail at a strategic spot in the fairway, trusting that any intruder would fall over it and give the alarm. Nothing happened, and I slept quietly. Next morning, however, the storm broke. Miss L. and I were peacefully at work in the kitchen when she suddenly caught up a carving knife and started after me, as mad as a March hare. Fortunately for me, I had in my hands a large saucepan full of freshly boiled greens, and I used this as a weapon of defense, and we danced round the kitchen table, slopping hot cabbage, water in all directions. We neither of us made a sound. I fended her off with the hot and sooty saucepan, and she slashed at me with an unpleasantly large carving knife. At a psychological moment in walked the head of the community. He took in the situation at a glance, and handled it by the tactful method of scolding us both impartially for making so much noise and telling us to get on with our work. Miss L. She was doing with the carver, I dished up the cabbage, and the incident passed off quietly. After lunch, Miss L. experienced the reaction from her excitement and went to her room completely prostrated with exhaustion. I was somewhat perturbed. Although used to mental cases, and therefore not as disturbed by the recent fracas as anyone else might have been, I did not relish the prospect of being the housemate of a dangerous lunatic who was under no sort of control. The head of the community, however, said there was no cause for alarm, he would soon have the case in hand. He went up to the bathroom, filled a soap dish with water from the tap, made certain passes over it, and dipping his finger in the water, proceeded to draw a five-pointed star upon the threshold of Miss L.'s room. Miss L. made no attempt to leave her room until 48 hours later, when he fetched her out himself. As he had promised, he soon had her in hand. He had several long talks with her, at which I was not present, and at the end of a few days a very chastened Miss L. began to go about her household duties again. There were relapses, and there were struggles, but in the course of a few weeks she became comparatively normal, and when I met her again some 18 months later there had been no relapse. Two curious incidents occurred during the period of her treatment at the hands of this man, an adept if ever there was. 1. The house in which she had a room was a very old one, and the front door exceedingly massive. It was secured at night by two enormous bolts that extended right across it, a chain that could have moored a barge, and a huge lock with a key the size of a trowel. When the door was opened in the morning, it acted as an alarm clock for the entire village. It creaked, it groaned, and it clanged. Yet night after night we came down in the morning to find this door standing ajar. We all slept with our doors open onto the small landing. To go down the ancient, creaking stairs was like walking on organ stops. The back door was a modern affair, which could have been opened easily. The windows were modern casements of the most gimcrack description. Who opened the heavy front door, and why? We exchanged recriminations several mornings at breakfast as to who had left the door open the night before, but no one could ever be convicted of the blame. Finally, the matter came to the knowledge of the head of the group. "I will soon put a stop to that," he said, and each night he re-sealed Miss L.'s room with the pentagram. We had no more trouble with the front door coming open after that. While he was dealing with Miss L., he made a practice of sealing the threshold of his own room in the same way, only in this case he drew the pentagram point outwards, to prevent Miss D. from coming in, whereas when he sealed her room, he put its point inwards, to prevent her coming out. She did not know this, nor was it likely to reach her ears indirectly, for he was very uncommunicative. I only knew that he was sealing his room because I chanced to see him doing it. Nevertheless, one day I heard a knock at my door, and there was Miss L., with her arms full of clean linen. She asked me if I would be good enough to take it into the room of the head of the community, and put it away. I asked her why she did not do so herself, for I knew he was out, and it was her work to put away the linen. She replied that she had been to his room for that purpose, but there was a psychic barrier across the threshold that prevented her entering.